This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
It's called protein degradation. And if you're a bad protein in a cancer cell, you'd better get your affairs in order. Because now, thanks to Dana-Farber's foundational work, protein degradation can target cancer-causing proteins and destroy them right inside the cell. This take-no-prisoners approach is making a difference in multiple myeloma and other blood cancers, and is how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Today, the Fed tells us about its plans for the economy.
And rule number one at the Fed is no surprises.
Marketplace Midday Update is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From APM, American Public Media, hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson in Los Angeles.
And in New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith, in for Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for downloading the podcast from Marketplace.org. It's Wednesday, April 27th.
Coming up, we'll find out what to expect from the Fed.
We'll get the latest on the hackers that have shut down Sony's PlayStation network and the data they've stolen.
And I'll interview the author of a new book about the rise and fall of Bernie Madoff.
Those stories and more coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
This podcast is supported by Carbonite Pro Online Backup, the automatic backup solution designed for small businesses. Learn more at carbonitepro.com.
We'll start today with the big news from the Fed. Today, the central bank will wrap up its two-day meeting in Washington with a short written statement.
And when it does, we'll hear what the Fed plans to do or not do for the economy going forward. Richard DeKayser is an economist with the Parthenon Group, and he's with us now, as he is each Wednesday, from Boston. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, first of all, we're not expecting any changes in interest rates. Is that right? Those are going to stay pretty low?
That's right.
And what about this other thing that we hear about every time we hear about the Fed? And I don't usually like to use this term, but it's quantitative easing. Why don't you tell us, first of all, what that's all about?
Sure. I mean, literally, it is increasing the quantity of money with the intention of easing economic conditions and promoting economic growth. Now, they've done this twice already. The first round of quantitative easing was between November 2008 through March of 2010.
Right.
It amounted to $1.3 trillion, during which time they bought U.S. debt, that is Treasury securities, as well as mortgage-backed securities. Now, in the middle of last year, we had a bit of a soft patch in the economy. They decided to go for round two, or quantitative easing two. That began in November of last year, is scheduled to run through June of this year, another $600 billion focused all on Treasuries. And this is all about trying to provide money to banks, to encourage banks to lend, and to provide lower interest rates, which encourages economic activity.
And today we're going to find out whether they are going to end that quantitative easing on schedule or continue it or stop it early.
That's exactly right. Those are the three options, and the most likely case is stay the course.
Okay. Now, put this in the context for us, Richard, of what else is going on in Washington. There's this big debate over the debt ceiling and whether there are going to be cuts coming. Is the Fed paying attention to what's going on in Congress?
Absolutely. The Fed is focused like a laser beam on what's happening in Congress because there's a lot of talk now about deficit reduction over the long term. If that were to occur, and that's a big if, the Fed would surely be easier with monetary policy because tighter fiscal policy tends to restrain the economy. They'd compensate with easier monetary policy. So they're focused like a laser beam on this. I don't think we're going to have any conclusions anytime soon, but this is going to be a long part of their watching and waiting game.
Richard DeKayser, economist at the Parthenon Group. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Well, while we don't know the exact wording, most economists have a pretty good idea of what the Fed is going to say. That's because the last thing the Fed wants to do is shock us. Marketplace's Eve Troeh explains. ING economist Rob Carnell says Ben Bernanke's statement today will only be about a dozen words different than the last time the Fed released its official statement. But guys like Carnell know what 12 words to listen for because they constantly track everything Bernanke says in public and make predictions on the tiniest changes in word choice.
You know, it's one adjective gets slightly upgraded or downgraded, and that's as much as you've got to go on. So you have to be quite a master of the English language as well.
Carnell says the Fed knows bankers are listening and chooses its words wisely. The last thing Bernanke wants to do is shock the markets with surprising news. But Carnell says with this first ever press conference, there's a wild card in how Bernanke delivers his lines.
There's always the off chance that he doesn't give a particularly smooth performance or gives a nuance the wrong way of what he actually intends.
And that uncertainty is why markets have been nervous leading up to this press conference, even if bankers already know the script. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
To workplace safety now, and a report out this morning that says the government agency charged with keeping us safe in the workplace, OSHA, is falling short. According to one of the country's largest unions, more than 4,000 workers died on the job in 2009. Marketplace's David Gura reports.
The AFL-CIO came to this conclusion.
Workplaces are getting safer.
That's Safety and Health Director Peg Seminario.
But we also see that there are significant problems that remain.
Workers inhaling silica, unsafe machinery. Seminario says while there are fewer jobs in some industries, the death rate has stayed constant.
While the numbers went down in construction, the rate did not.
The AFL-CIO wants tougher enforcement and higher fines.
I'm skeptical of fines in general and absolutely skeptical of fines that are rules-based.
Robert Sandy teaches economics at Indiana University. He says a company shouldn't pay a penalty if a railing is too low because its height might not have made a difference. But if a worker gets injured or dies, that's another story. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
The government said this morning that businesses upped their orders of heavy machinery last month for the third straight month. That's good news because some thought durable goods orders would drop off because of rising oil prices.
The UK is reporting this morning its economy grew by a minuscule 0.5% last quarter. Economists are blaming the stagnation there on steep spending cuts by the government.
More numbers anytime at our website, marketplace.org. Just go to the numbers section.
This podcast is supported by Carbonite Pro Online Backup, the automatic backup solution designed for small businesses. Carbonite Pro automatically backs up computer files to a secure location with anytime, anywhere access from any computer or smartphone. Learn more at carbonitepro.com.
Sony's PlayStation Network has been offline for a week now, and the world found out why last night. Sony says a ton of sensitive personal information has been hacked. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
Sony's PlayStation Network has roughly 77 million members worldwide. Each of them gave their email, a physical address, and a password to the company. Many millions gave credit card information as well.
I've been reading criticism of Sony that what took them a week to tell us. I think it took them a week to find out the extent of the breach.
Michael Pachter is a video game analyst at Wedbush Securities. He says at this point, no one knows who the hacker is or what his or her intentions are.
If it's somebody who's really stealing, the effects of this hack could linger for months or for years.
Still, Pachter doesn't think the breach will bury Sony's gaming business.
It's not like closing down your Yahoo account and going somewhere else. The switching cost here is you have to go spend $300 to buy an Xbox 360 and $60 a year to join Xbox Live.
But the security breach could cost Sony some real money. Already, one U.S. senator is calling on the company to insure its customers against any possible identity theft. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Let's get some analysis now from Roger Kay, CEO of Endpoint Technologies. Roger, good morning.
Good morning, Stacey. How are you?
Good, thank you. So we've had several data breaches like this recently. What does this kind of data compromise mean for consumers?
When a hacker gets into a network like this, they can do a number of things, but probably one of the worst is that they can filch personal data from the users. And in this case, there are 77 million users of the PlayStation Network.
And credit card data is one of the things that might have been compromised, right?
Right. They're saying that it's a possibility, and so they're warning their users.
Now, PlayStation is a huge moneymaker for Sony. It's not only taken a PR hit from this news, but it's also been offline for a week. How serious is this for the company?
Well, it's serious on two levels. In the sense that the network is unavailable for players, that's mostly annoying the younger users who actually don't care that much about personal data. They say, oh, it's out there anyway. Just give us back our network. And on the other level, it's a larger issue because it shows that cloud services like this actually can be compromised, and users who are just getting used to putting their stuff online are now facing the idea that perhaps it's not safe and maybe they shouldn't do so.
Will Sony recover from this, do you think?
Oh, they certainly will recover, but it tarnishes their image, at least in the short term.
Roger Kay with Endpoint Technologies. Roger, thank you so much.
Thank you, Stacey.
Jeremy, guess what?
What?
Do you know what the latest casualty of state budget cuts is?
Uh-oh, what is it?
The Final Frontier.
What do you mean?
So the famous SETI Institute in Northern California, uh-huh. which has all of those, that scans the skies for alien life, it's been shut down by budget cuts.
Wow. So no more scanning for aliens.
I know. I have this feeling abductions are going to go up now. SETI needs about $5 million to return to prosperity and keep tabs on all of those billions and billions of stars.
Well, maybe one of the Marketplace podcast listeners will chip in the money so that important work can go on.
I know. Well, I think maybe they hear us in outer space and the aliens themselves will contribute.
Bernie Madoff is serving a 150-year prison sentence for carrying out the largest Ponzi scheme in history. Journalist Diana Henriquez was the first to interview Madoff in prison, and she's got a book out this week about his rise and fall. It's called The Wizard of Lies. Diana Henriquez joins us now from New York. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
Well, you were the first person to interview Bernie Madoff in prison. What was he like?
The first visit that I had with him, he was very crisp, very dapper. My second visit in February, I saw just a dramatic change after his son's suicide. He was shattered. In fact, there was a button unbuttoned on his shirt that he didn't even notice until more than halfway through our interview.
That was the thing that really got to him, the suicide of his son?
It seemed to. I didn't actually see, I'm often asked if I see remorse in him, and I must confess, there's more denial than remorse. I don't think he actually understands how much damage he has done, or at least he hasn't accepted it to himself.
Bernie Madoff's wife, Ruth, has not been charged with a crime. There's been a lot of investigation, and still no charge. Why do you think there's been such vitriol from the public toward Ruth?
I've given that a lot of thought, Jeremy, because in fact, if you go back through centuries, the criminal is derided and attacked, but the family is usually left alone. Ruth remained with Madoff, and that seemed to be the triggering event. But from my research, I know that Ruth felt she couldn't abandon him. They'd been married for 50 years, and she just couldn't walk away from him. And I think she got punished for that, frankly.
This case was a huge embarrassment for the federal government and particularly the Securities and Exchange Commission. How could regulators not have figured out what was going on?
Well, it's painful to read. It was painful to write, to see all of the missed opportunities. But we must remember what had happened to the American regulatory structure after several decades of deregulation and small budgets. They came tantalizingly, agonizingly close so many times.
There's been a big overhaul of regulations in this country since the Madoff affair. Do you think that the SEC is in a better position to stop a crime like this in the future?
It's in a better position to manage its resources. It's a good start. But the ability of regulators to get inside a Ponzi scheme and stop it is always going to be limited to how alert those investors are. And so what I hope people will take away from the book is the knowledge and wisdom they need to protect themselves against these very plausible crooks.
Diana Henriquez, author of The Wizard of Lies. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Jeremy.
And you can read an excerpt from Diana's book at our big book blog at marketplace.org.
At a ceremony this weekend in Rome, Pope John Paul II will get one step closer to becoming a saint. For Rome's tourism industry, big Vatican events like this usually draw in millions of people and millions of dollars. Usually. Megan Williams has more.
It's the usual spring rush at Rome's oldest tourist operator, Corani Tours. In January, the Vatican announced that Pope John Paul II would be beatified this Sunday. So travel agents like this one began to prepare for a surge in tourists. Instead, manager Roberta Zito says,
it was like a balloon that then popped. As the day started to come closer, the interest died down.
Previous crowds for beatification ceremonies, like the one for Mother Teresa, drew several million. That event was announced a year ahead, but the Vatican announced the celebration for John Paul less than 4 months ago. People rushed to book hotels, which jacked up prices, only to find flights to Rome were a problem.
People coming from the United States didn't have time, and also the airlines, they were giving the seats, but at very high rates.
Zito says Americans also realized they wouldn't even be guaranteed a decent seat at the ceremony.
It's an open event, basically first come, first serve. So I think a lot of people realized that the possibility of actually being in St. Peter's Square or around it was going to be very unlikely.
Down the street is the Santina Hotel. It's one of five run by Giuseppe Roscioli, president of Rome's Hoteliers Association.
Normally we are fully booked for the 5th of May. Now we are not.
Roscioli says there are 20,000 more vacancies than last May, when there was no big event. The prospect of all the Vatican crowds pouring in kept regular tourists away.
So the normal tourism, they don't come in Rome during this period. It's the same that I want to make a weekend in Monte Carlo. Probably I will not choose the weekend that is the formal one because it's a big event.
Which makes it a good time to get a cheap room here. In Rome, I'm Megan Williams for Marketplace.
And finally, Stacey, there is the housing market, and then there's the housing market in the Hamptons, close to you, where billionaire right. David Tepper bought a mansion last year for $43 million, and he's just gotten approval to tear it down.
Oh, my gosh.
The house has a tennis court. It's got big marble bathrooms and a sun-drenched living room with an ocean view, I'm sure just like yours, your house in the Hamptons.
Absolutely, yes. But why is he tearing this mansion down?
At 6,100 square feet, it is a bit of a tight squeeze for Tepper. And so after he tears it down, he's going to replace it with a house twice the size, which is, I'm sure, just what most Americans are doing with their homes at this point.
Once you have three tennis courts, you just can't go back. This is what I hear.
Well, in Los Angeles and heading back to my enormous mansion with three tennis courts, swimming pools, and an ocean view, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And in New York and heading back to my hovel in Brooklyn, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith, and this is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.